Accession number 28650, Mr. Gordon Mellor, Reel 13. Now, we're talking about this typical bomber raid on Cologne.
Yes.
We've been talking about how you'd adjust the course with dog legs to adjust the time and things.
The timing.
What happen next? I mean, what would happen for you during the rest of it?
We would employ the rear gunner when possible and the front gunner to keep an eye on the ground to shout if he saw any significant landmarks such as a river, lake, or a dark patch of woods or something which have got a special shape. This was purely in addition to their normal duties, and they're sort of scanning the horizon and the sky and the ground most of the time. So they used to give me a bit of help, especially when one was in moonlight and you could see it reflecting off a river. And they would, over the intercom, they would say, "We are here now." And I could get the time off of my clock or watch so that it was related exactly to the time that my watch was running.
Now, could you see at all the ground?
Most of the time, one was in the navigational position, and it was only some of the Wellingtons which had windows down the sides of them, a long strip of clear perspex. This was more the earlier models. Most of the ones that we flew had no fenestration in the body of the aircraft, though some of them did have a gunner's position, inverted triangle with a position to place a machine gun. There again, that was only on some of them. So that if I wanted to see the ground, we had just the one pilot, the one captain, then I could go up into the second pilot's position and see the ground from there. Or on occasions, one perhaps caught a glimpse by putting head through the astrodome and sort of getting a very oblique view of the ground there. You would be seeing it some miles away, so it was of less value to me. That really is, if we were running a bit late, then there was the only solution was to rev up the engines a bit and increase our airspeed, in which case I'd then have to make adjustment on the timing and on the onto the next turning point or the target.
Now, just a couple of questions I forgot to ask. Some of them were offered wakey-wakey pills, or amphetamines we'd call them now. Did you ever take them, or were you aware of them?
They were always offered. The doctor attended the principal briefing, and they were offered for those who wanted them. I can't ever remember even taking them with me.
Was there any reason why not, or did you just...
didn't need them. And in actual fact, it's said that in some cases they had the reverse effect. I think it was quite rare, but it's... I didn't really need them, so I thought, well, I won't take them.
What about any... Would you take any food or drink with you? I mean... Flask of coffee or something.
Some people did. I didn't. Occasionally I had a bar of chocolate or something like that. We're not advertising, but Kit Kat was quite a chocolate biscuit. But no, normally it didn't occur to me, or I didn't feel I wanted and needed it anyhow.
And what about the toilet facilities? Was it Nelsan?
Oh, yes.
And was that ever used, or did people use it?
Rarely, I would say. They might have done on the last stages of the journey back home, but the pilot had a funnel and a pipe, and as far as I know, he didn't use it. There have been cases when the Elson's been used, the pilot has gone back and used it, and on those cases then I managed to gain a certain amount of piloting experience. We tried to swap jobs around with the gunners and what have you, and the wireless operator, so that somebody could stand in in an emergency to take over. And I was very fortunate. I did get quite a number of hours, unofficially, of course. The navigation suffered a little from that.
Now, so what would happen next? What about, I mean, the route would go, would it presumably over France, would it? Or
well, in this particular instance, I think we went straight across to somewhere like Furnes on the Belgian coast, not far from Dunkirk or Ostend, and we cut through there. There was a searchlight, or there appeared to be a searchlight belt that you had to pass through, and we wouldn't exactly head for the straight for the target, and very often we'd head in a slightly other direction, as if we were going to pass place where we were intending to drop the bombs, and then turn off on a short leg straight for the aiming point.
Now, when would you start to become troubled by either German night fighters or AA?
Well, the German night fighters could appear anywhere from the coast on, and AKAC. You had to go largely over a concentration of a town or something of that style, and they seemed to be scattered around the towns more in protection of the built-up area. We got a few sort of small pieces hit the fuselage on occasions, but others. It wasn't unusual to see one of our aircraft going down, having been blasted by a night fighter. You would see it way ahead, or perhaps off to the side, and you'd note the time, and one would report that back, your position and time when you had to see this, so that they could perhaps take the matter further. There also was the fact that when you're on quite a long straight run, then the AKAC batteries on either side would throw up a shell and exploded at your height, and you found that one after the other they were mirroring your track, but perhaps a couple of miles away, and that would give an indication, I presumed, to the night fighters that somewhere at that height, way over on their left, there was aircraft going through, which of course probably was the main mainstream.
Now, did you ever sight, or not you, or did your aircraft sight aircraft or German night fighters?
On the odd occasion, one slid down below. You could just pick it out in the dark, but he presumably hadn't seen us.
You were lucky they never attacked you. Not on this raid, or
No.
What happened as you neared the target? What would the procedure be? I presume you'd be quite busy checking everything.
Yes, I wanted to be sure that we were heading for the right target. But normally, we were in the fire-raising part of the raid, so that it had already started, and you could see it from 50, 60 miles away if it was going strong. So that we kept to our course if it was obvious we were heading in the general right direction, and rely on navigation until we got a lot closer. Then when it became obvious, then the pilot then made a survey of what was going on, and he attacked from whichever point he thought was the most advantageous.
Now, what was the procedure of the actual bombing run?
Oh, well, I would, those early days, I would go down into the front of the aircraft, into the nose, and apply whatever information is necessary on the bomb site.
You'd act as bomb aimer?
Oh, yes, that was one of the things I was trained for.
Now, tell me about the bomb site and how you'd use it. Or that, if you can remember.
I can remember. I thought I'd described this already. They were the Mark 9, the ones that we used.
You did describe some of this,
yes. You had to allow for the wind or the drift, as we should say, on there, and you had to position the aircraft so that it was running up towards the aiming point. And on this particular bomb site, then there was an arm sticking out forward, and there was a series of wires on either side which were parallel to it. So they aided you to get the aircraft into the right line of approach, and so that you went straight for it. And the drift, whatever it was allowed for. You had to set your height on it, and your airspeed, I think. And there were some figures you had to set depending on the type of bomb load you got. There was a compass bowl there as well. I don't know that that was of great use to us, other than the fact recording we'd bomb perhaps in a northeasterly direction or easterly or something of that style. But we were given the direction we were supposed to pass over the target during the briefing, and we kept to that as much as possible, depending upon the defences.
Now, what about the actual final thing? So you correct the pilot's course, would you?
Oh yes, there was a a patter that we used to use: left, left, right. Two words on the left and right on the right hand side. So that if he only heard one word above the noise or whatever was going on, then he would know it was sort of turned to the right. Or if he heard two words, no matter what they were, he could then turn to the appropriate direction. And the other word was steady. And once you've got the target running down the wires and down your aim, sights, then a repetition of steady all the time kept him informed as to how we were doing. And I would chuck in perhaps the odd comment coming up about another half minute or something like that, and not always.
And
I'd probably say getting close.
How would you actually release the bombs?
You had to arm them first. There were a number of switches on the side which activated disarming device, the priming device on the bombs, and they pulled the wires out so that once the wires were pulled out, then the fuses would work on impact on the ground. So you switch those all on. You switch the camera on, which was already preset in the back of the part of the fuselage, and you had a button like a bell push, and when it all joined up in the right point, you just pressed the button, and the bombs went away in the sequence which you had indicated on the timer, which was on the side of the aircraft. There was a round timer, very much like a electric switch that you use for switching lights on and off these days, but there was an arm which sort of sprang round, and that had been set so that the bombs went off into the required sequence.
And did it make a difference to the plane when the bombs were gone?
The heavier sort of load you were carrying, then you felt a rise as the aircraft sort of had the load taken off. But I don't suppose it was really very, very much feet.
Now, when you were in the front, you know, bombing, was there much view of shrapnel coming? Not shrapnel, AK-AK coming up towards you?
I mean, oh, over the
what
target.
Did it look like?
Well, when you approached it, the primary colour that you saw was yellow. And after they introduced the Pathfinder force, then, of course, you had target markers and target indicators and what have you with other colours. But there was a lot of yellow. There was a lot of light from searchlights. And there were fires, of course, if you were coming along later on after the raid had progressed for some time. There were quite some conflagrations going, and you could see other bombs going off down below. With the 4 pounds incendiaries, it took a little while to get hold on anything that was flammable if they dropped into roads, and of course they just burned themselves out on the road surface. There was something else I was going to mention about that. You could certainly see the light flat coming up. It's like a whole series string of lights, and it was like water coming from a hose pipe. It used to sort of wave around. Heavy flak you didn't see until it came close to you. Although if anybody on an adjoining aircraft or one way off got coned by several searchlights, then of course the gunners would then concentrate on the top of the cone of the searchlights where they all cross together and give it a pasting. And it was a job to, once you were coned, it was a job to get out.
That never happened to you?
We've had it scan the searchlights pass over the wings, been very close. I don't recall ever sort of being in the top of the cone.
Now, what was your nerve like? I mean, how nerve wracking was it doing this? I mean, did you suffer from nerves at all?
Not really, no. It was such a blaze of light. You can't. Fire bombs had laid, then there was a string of light. Or in many cases, if it went across wooden buildings and what have you, then they would be burning. So you could see a whole trail of which one aircraft would drop down, and there were dozens of them. There was also the flash going off for camera, and most of the other aircraft, I think, all had flash with them. So there was this sort of yellow glow in the glare in the sky with them. Varying colours down below, especially if there was any target indicators going down. And there was also the searchlights and the flash going off all over the place. It was quite horrific in actual fact. I think there were people down there, but then it had happened in London, so we took it that they were getting their own back.
Can you talk about that? How did you feel about German civilians that were caught up in it? I mean, is that what you basically thought?
It crossed my mind once or twice. I think it did with everybody. But of course, with the raid we're talking about with Cologne, when it was announced that it was a 1,000 bomber raid, then there was quite a strong cheer went up. I think at least this is something that's going to be big. And you sort of swept across the target. You had to fly straight and level, of course, to drop the bombs. And your approach along the line to the aiming point. And when we pressed the button, then you had to wait for the flash to go off, and that was. Quite a few seconds before it got down to the level to explode. And in theory, then the aiming point should have been in the middle of your photograph. If it wasn't, then you hadn't dropped your bombs on your particular aiming point.
Now, what would happen then? So you've taken your photograph.
Oh, when you've taken your photograph, then. They probably had been plotting your down below in the ACAC people. Then they probably, or somebody had been plotting your route across, and you cut the straight and level part down as short as possible, so that having sort of the flash gone off, you then, or at least the pilot then, diverted the aircraft away from the route we were going. And wait for the perimeter of the target area to get out of the flak. Of course, when you got out of the flak, there's always the possibility of a night fighter.
So that was a continue, you know, didn't go away.
Oh no, the you were at risk as even when you were going across the channel or something like that. But it increased with the. Amount of armament and fighters that were available as you approached the target and also as you came out.
Now, your log, or this extract from your log, says you also dropped some propaganda pamphlets as well.
Oh, yes.
Munchen, is that Munich? Munchen, anyway.
Well, yes. Oh, there's another place called Munchen Gladbach.
Of course there is, yes, sorry.
It's not an uncommon name. You'll find there's a sample there that red and black thing on the right hand side is one, and there's some further on. They were related to the particular area that you were going to raid on that night. Some of them were French ones, which we dropped over French territory, of course.
But this is a German one that was dropped over Munchen.
Yeah.
And did it seem funny to be dropping leaflets as well as bombs?
No, not really. I mean, I think most people could see that you have to get at the whole population to get the war called off. The civilian population didn't have much choice. They just had to take it. But we tried to gain a little bit of an angle on them. And in some cases, then they were just no more than notices of family people being killed whilst on active service.
Now, so what about your route back, or was the journey back? Anything different?
Oh yes, you'd swing away from the target, and your route back was given to you. We tried to stick to it as much as possible. It certainly would not be the reciprocal of the way in, because of raids such as this one here took 90 minutes, so you could be over the target and halfway home practically before the last man went through. So that you didn't want to have a face-on altercation with one of your own side. And we used to generally start going downhill, if I can put it like that. Get over the Belgian coast at, 7,000-8,000 feet perhaps, and gradually decrease our height as we swept up the North Sea, up the East Coast, or perhaps as we went into across the East Coast and went up inland. But on many a morning we went up at sea, and I used to drop down so that when it was daylight, the sun was behind you, and you could see you've got a glorious sunny day turning up in the summer. We'd approach Mablethorpe on the coast of Lincolnshire, probably be down to about 1,000 feet. And it was a nice winding down. It was very pleasant to see it all again, the green and the houses. Go over one or two big houses with estates, and sort of sweep up towards the aerodrome. That was very pleasant.
Now, what about the landing procedure or routine?
The pilot used to be in control there. He called up, hello, whatever our particular code name was for the station. It might come back.
Okay.
Might not. And we'd then enter the circuit, so to speak, that they give you a height to circle round. And if there was a lot of aircraft coming in round about the same time, because we'd all gone off more or less at the same time, then you would be stacked up there, and you'd gradually be told to come down to a certain level. And eventually you got to the bottom of the heap, and you were given your number two on the circuit or something of that, so that he would then go into the landing procedure. We'd all leave our various places, and except for the second pilot, if he was there, he would be sitting with the side of the pilot, and we'd sit in the body of the aircraft just in case there was a defect or anything went wrong. And just wait until the wheels touched down, and there'd be the usual comment as to whether it was a good landing or a bad one.
Now, would they usually be good, or?
Oh, yes. I flew with some excellent pilots.
So after you landed?
Oh, we then went to the wherever there was a junction off, if the runways crossed, and it was advantageous to turn down an unused runway, or otherwise we went to the perimeter track and then taxied round to pad where you started from. The same aircraft mostly had the same hard standing to use. They were all numbered, and we knew where they all were.
And
you then sort of packed up your gear and got out. On the one odd occasion, yes, there was one occasion, then we had to hang up on a can of incendiaries, so that we made a very gentle landing. And when we taxied round, and the engine's off, and all the rest of it, and we were standing there. I'm not sure whether we were well aware that it was how much was left in the can. Anyhow, we were getting out of the aircraft, and suddenly the 4-pound incendiaries dropped onto the tarmac below. But when the airmen were was there with a fire extinguisher, but they didn't ignite at all. So it was just a matter of packing up and waiting for lorry or one of the lights, commercial type vehicles, to pick us up and take us back to the site offices where you disrobed.
So that'd be in the flight office?
Yes, the flight office, yes.
And what would the debriefing be like?
We got rid of our gear. Most of the time we had lockers there, so that our own locker, so you could pile all your unwanted gear, your flying gear, and navigation instruments into the locker. I'd take the log with me, that, and the chart that I'd been working on, and we would go to the ops room, which was close to headquarters, the station headquarters. So you'd sit at a table. If there was a table vacant, you would sit there. If not, you had to wait until one crew finished, and you all sat as a crew, as a crew, with one of the interrogating officers.
And what would it be like for you?
The pilot had first go, and he explained what had happened. And we were then, the rest of the crew, were then give any comments about the your particular side of the business. Sometimes there wasn't a lot to say, other than the fact, well, we found the met was a bit wrong, the winds were way out, or say we passed through a front and the winds changed quite considerably more than we expected. Or they were a bit heavier and we sort of were having to lose time. Just the general things which affected your performance.
And how long would the briefing go on for about?
For each crew, you were usually supplied with a cup of coffee. How long does it take a cup of coffee to go? 10, 12 minutes.
And then would you get the crew meal again, or this?
Oh yes, you'd go back for breakfast, and we usually gain sat as a crew. Sometimes two or three crews mixed up, but very often some of us would then not go straight to bed. We'd go off into the room where they got snooker tables and billiards, and we'd play a couple of games of snookers to wind down. You just didn't feel like sleep immediately. But, yes, and as it was very often, it was daylight, the sun was shining,